to another edition of The Peace Production, the podcast from the Organization for World Peace, where we examine current issues threatening human security. Today, we have the honor and pleasure of interviewing Michael Collins, the Executive Director of the Institute for Economics and Peace, to discuss the findings of the organization's most recent Global Peace Index report. My name is Andrew Bernstein, and joining me today is Monica Sager. Hi, Monica.
Hi there.
The Institute for Economics and Peace is an independent think tank dedicated to changing how the world approaches peace by making it a tangible and achievable measure of human well-being and development. The report is the 14th edition of its kind and ranks 163 independent states and territories according to their level of peacefulness. It presents a comprehensive data-driven analysis to date on trends in peace, its economic value, and how to develop peaceful societies. Hi, Michael, and welcome.
Thank you very much. Hi, Andy.
So, Michael, to start off, could you please start by introducing the IEP a bit more to our audience and explain why the work that you do is so important in today's world?
Yeah, absolutely, Monica. I'd be very happy to. So, as Andy mentioned, we are an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan research institute. As he said, our focus is essentially to shift the world's focus to peace as a positive, achievable, and tangible measure of human well-being and progress. So, to do that, essentially, we develop metrics to analyze peace. We quantify its economic value, and we're particularly interested in uncovering the relationships between business, peace, and prosperity, promoting a better understanding of the factors that create peace. To sort of put it more simply, we try and answer the question, what are the most peaceful countries on Earth, and what do they have in common? The idea is if we can sort of find that out, then we can help less peaceful countries become more peaceful, essentially. As to why it's important, well, until we become more peaceful, we're never really going to have the sort of the levels of trust and cooperation that we need to be able to tackle the world's most pressing challenges, right? Such as climate change, scarcity of resources, the growing population, and of course, very relevant today, pandemics, for example.
Michael, what factors are taken into account when ranking a state's peacefulness?
So the definition of peacefulness we use for the Global Peace Index is the lack of violence or fear of violence. So the metrics we look for really relate negatively to that, if you will. So we have a whole series of indicators. We split them into three different domains. So there's a domestic and external conflict domain, for example. That would include things like the number and intensity and duration of conflicts, the number of deaths, relations with neighboring countries, for example. The second domain would be safety and security. So that's everything that's more internal, police rates, homicide and incarceration rates, impact of terrorism. Then the third domain would be militarization. That includes things like military expenditure, for example, the availability of small arms, nuclear and heavy weapons capability, for example.
In the report, it states that you have 23 qualitative and quantitative indicators. Could you mention some of the qualitative ones?
Yeah, with regards to the qualitative indicators, so these are used essentially to complement and contextualize it in place where data may not be widely available. So relations with neighboring countries, for example, is one of them. Perceived criminality, the likelihood of violent demonstrations, political instability, for example. These are kind of sort of things that although they're very tangible and very noticeable, there's not always a data point for.
And over the last year, then, in your report, what are some of the global trends in peace that you've seen within the world?
As a whole, peacefulness has deteriorated. We're pretty specific, so 0.34%, right? This is the ninth deterioration, essentially, in the last 12 years. And when we look at it globally, we see sort of 81 countries have improved in levels of peacefulness and 80 have deteriorated. In terms, when we look at it sort of over the domains, if you will, the militarization improved, although there has been an increase in military expenditure for essentially, I think, the first time in 5 years. Safety and security and ongoing conflict, that's deteriorated, but homicide rates and terrorism indicators have continued to improve. The MENA region or the Middle East and North Africa, that continues to be the least peaceful region. So, you know, 4 of the 10 least peaceful countries on Earth are in this region here. None of these countries are in the top 25. Europe, on the other end of the scale, continues to be the most peaceful, although there has been an increase in civil unrest. So 17 countries in Europe right now are in the top 25, and there's only one that's on the bottom 25. Now, in the GPI, we also do, as well as sort of the year-on-year snapshot of peacefulness, we also do trends over time. And over the past 10 years, we've seen that peacefulness has dropped nearly 2.5%. civil unrest, which I mentioned briefly before, that's increasing around the world, as are the numbers of conflicts, right? So, but we are moving from sort of large theaters of war, I think the Iraq and Syria war, to sprouting out, if you will, of smaller regional conflicts around the world. It's not all doom and gloom. Deaths from terrorism, for example, I mentioned that briefly before, they're at their lowest level in a decade. And we also see this continuous drop in homicide rates as a trend as well over the last 10 years.
When one looks at the report, it kind of strikes out that the gap between the least and most peaceful countries continues to grow. Mm-hmm. What do you think accounts for this?
We sort of see that over the past decade, the 25 least peaceful countries, they deteriorated by nearly 13%, right? Whereas the most peaceful countries improved by about 2%. I think this speaks to essentially the impact of violence, that violence has on a country's coping capacity. Peace allows for institutions to become stronger over time. The absence of conflict allows for sort of more focus on socioeconomic development. That builds trust and reduces grievances. On the other hand, conflict erodes institutions, right? And it diverts their focus from sort of serving citizens and to resolving the crisis at hand. And this can create more grievances, essentially results in sort of a vicious cycle or violence trap.
One thing that I think is interesting is that in order to grow peace and increase the levels, it seems like the process that leads you there is a much longer one than it actually takes to deteriorate and actually, you know, go in the other opposite direction. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, that absolutely is the case. And that's something that we see very clearly through the data. To put it simply, we say that it's a lot more difficult to create peace than it is to destroy it. You're absolutely right, Andy. And we see the drops. I mean, through the data, we see the drops in peacefulness always happen so much more when going down than going up. So like you say, building peace is very progressive and does require lengths of time. All the more reason to start now, right?
Correct.
You said about Europe being the world's most peaceful region on average, but recently we've seen a decline in safety and security and ongoing conflict. What is happening in this continent?
Yeah, so civil unrest in Europe has increased essentially over the past 6 to 7 years. Over that time, there's been over 1,500 protests. This includes, you know, anti-government protests, general strikes and riots. You know, a large percent of these protests are non-violent, right? 65%, but that also means that there are some that are not. And the reasons are varied, but I think they're kind of sort of overall symptomatic of some of the wider global trends that we're seeing. So largely related to perceived inequality or inequality and failures in governance as well. You know, in the case of Europe, I think that historically, or at least you know, within this sort of the last 10 years again, this was, of course, aggravated by the Syrian refugee crisis. And all of this has essentially sort of led to this increasing levels of polarization and the resulting political instability as well. Of course, this is being aggravated even more now because of COVID-19. I suppose the bad news there is that we also sort of see these trends continuing over the coming years as well, not only in Europe, but in other places around the world.
Michael, how important are transnational institutions such as the EU to the peacefulness of their members?
So I think they're very important, generally. I mean, you talk about the EU. I'm in New York. If it's okay, let me extend that to the UN, if I can.
Absolutely.
You know, we often criticize these multilateral organizations for what they sort of fail to do. And rightly so, but we often sort of forget what they've achieved, right? I mean, historically, I think they've been very successful in resolving disputes and improving socioeconomic development in the case of the EU. You know, both of these contribute to higher levels of peace, right? So I do think these institutions are under increasing pressure to perform. It's funny because we actually hope to complete in the near future an analysis of nations' commitment to multilateralism. And that's because we increasingly see nation states coming to their own arrangements with other nations outside of these institutions, right? Sort of more regional arrangements, more bilateral arrangements. And there's also increasing pressure from civil society as well. You know, a lot of people think that these institutions aren't doing enough to address global challenges such as climate change, etc. Are they becoming more irrelevant? Maybe, but do they have, you know, still have plenty to give and can they adapt? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, when one looks at the global trend, no one would think that there's a conflict between these people that are consider themselves to be globalists, right, and defend kind of a global governance system And also some people who think that a return to the nation state and some kind of populistic nationalism might be a response to the challenges that we see right now. What is the Institute for Economics and Peace's stance in that term?
We don't have a stance. You know, what we try and do is we try and present the data and for people to have their own conclusions. In fact, we're always very careful to not to jump to conclusions with our data and to kind of sort of present it in a very open way. The only thing that I can probably say is that, yes, you're right. That is definitely what we are observing. If your question is to what way should we go, then we generally prefer not to comment because I don't think that we would be qualified. But I definitely think that it is something that we are seeing, Andy. And I do think that is in consequence in large part because there's a sector of society that is increasingly focused on moving forward, so progressive. And the counter to that is a portion of society that is just not prepared essentially to move as far forward as some would like. Now, you know, invariably, as with everything, I imagine there's a happy medium somewhere. But of course, you know, there's always kind of this back and forth of the pendulum as we kind of sort of do that. And what we see in a lot of our work is that, and I think it's very much systemic, right? And as the environment sort of presses changes on human society, systems need to adapt. And everything that we're going through now and have been going through since the inception of humankind, if you will, has been this process of adaptation to our environment. And in many ways, this back and forth is a natural process to see where we settle. Sorry, that ended up being a bit philosophical.
Well, I think that we need to go into the details.
Okay.
Would you say that economic disparity is one of the main drivers for internal conflict? And what indicators are most affected by this economic disparity?
I'd say it's definitely a contributing factor if we extend that to safety and security indicators. So, for example, the increase in civil unrest, right, that we've seen throughout the world. You know, many of the reasons for that are economic in nature. So broadly speaking, we see more evident or visible income disparity and a greater divide between rich and poor, but also a number of actions that sort of leads directly or affect people's pockets directly, right? Austerity measures, cuts to welfare, fuel subsidies, social security reform, etc. So all of this can lead to it can increase the likelihood of violent demonstrations, levels of violent crime. That can then impact incarceration and police rates, for example, you know. And then largely through our positive peace work, we see that equitable distribution of resources is very strongly correlated to highly peaceful societies as well. An inherent characteristic of peaceful societies is better levels of equality or more equality, I should say.
You've mentioned positive peace a few times now. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So we define positive peace as the attitudes, institutions, and structures that create and sustain peaceful societies. So we all perhaps have our own, you know, gut feeling as to what these are, but at IP we try and sort of analyze that quantitatively, right? We take thousands of cross-country measures of economic, social progress and essentially try and sort of determine which are most correlated to peaceful societies as measured by the GPI, the Global Peace Index. So out of all of those, we found over 200 indicators that correlate very strongly. And these can be placed, broadly speaking, into 8 buckets, right? That are essentially the qualities of peaceful nations. We call them the 8 pillars of positive peace. So they are a well-functioning government, an equitable distribution of resources, free flow of information, good relations with neighbors, high levels of human capital, acceptance of the rights of others, low levels of corruption, and a sound business environment, right? These are the key characteristics of peaceful societies. And one of the important things is that we also see through the data that these pillars lead to other many great things as well. So strong economic development, better environmental performance, increased well-being, higher levels of resilience to crises such as COVID-19.
When one looks at the positive peace index, there's a large decline in attitudes. What do you think accounts for it?
I wish I knew, Andy. I wish I knew. You know, we see all pillars of positive peace are completely interrelated and independent. So the short answer is it's a wide array of factors, right? We have seen a generalized increase in group grievances. This is, you know, due to perceived and real inequalities, some of which you're speaking about before. You know, broadly speaking, a disconnect between governments and their people, once again, represented by these pressures on the multilateral system that we were talking about. And I think that sort of, you know, the new forms of communication and technology really help amplify some of this for good and for bad. And some of the sort of the freedoms that open communication provides can also be exploited, right?
We made a podcast here at the Peace Production about fake news and COVID-19. And I wanted to ask you specifically about this because it's an area of my interest. How pervasive is the spread of fake news for peace? But right now, it feels like fake news has become one of the most important or most talked about factors in terms of polarizing a society. So I imagine that you must have analyzed the effects of fake news.
It's funny that you mentioned that, actually, because I have a colleague that is starting to work on some of that right now to be able to establish what the network is. And we haven't ourselves conducted that research because ultimately it is very hard to decide what is fake news, essentially, right? And then we're kind of sort of getting into the dynamic of what is of what side of that divide that we were talking about before essentially is right or is wrong. So we haven't gone ourselves into that level of analysis, but what I can say is that with regards to disinformation generally, that is something that we see does lead to significant increase in group grievances and posterior drops in peacefulness as well. So in the same way that we see that liberal democracies, for example, are generally a lot more peaceful than authoritarian regimes, one of the reasons for that is the general messiness of democracy, right? And the ability of people to be able to interact with each other and for opinions to be shared. That is something that is not possible in more authoritarian regimes. And that leads to these societies being a lot less adaptable. And that in itself generates conflict.
Now, the circumstances for the report on 2020 are definitely going to be somewhat special given the outbreak of COVID-19. So how does an unexpected and hardly controllable situation such as this pandemic affect global and interstate peacefulness?
I don't think we're going to know for a long time, you know, as this sort of data comes in. As we know, you know, right here in the US right now, there's a sort of a second large spike, and we imagine that that's going to happen in a number of other countries. But you know, what we do expect is that it will affect peacefulness around the world. I'm seeing the anecdotal effects of this, if you will, in New York right now, and perhaps you have too, with frequent arguments breaking out on the street related to mask wearing and social distancing. I see that only getting worse in the next few days, and that's just at a very local level. But looking forward, I think that sort of the main source of tension is probably going to be the economy globally. So countries are going to really have to sort of tighten their belts, and unemployment will increase. So I think that that's also going to lead to civil unrest, and a knock-on effects of countries sort of tightening their belts is that we're also going to see a drop in foreign aid, right, to countries that are already in very fragile states. So I think that could have significant impact as well. If there is a sort of a silver lining to this, is that we also expect military expenditure to go down as people redirect funds to their own economies. The general projection, if you will, is that the peacefulness may continue to deteriorate over the coming years.
Gotcha. So then how would the positive peace indicator be a good measure for the current and future impact of COVID-19?
As I mentioned before, countries with high levels of positive peace are essentially shown to be more resilient to crises, right, such as COVID-19. They're inherently more diverse in all aspects. That provides many more avenues for tackling the problem, essentially. And COVID-19 is interesting because there needs to be a significant and rapid change to society in order to mitigate the threat, right? And the jolt on the system, if you will, can be really severe. So positive peace is essentially a measure of suppleness, of health of the system, right? By improving that indicator, you're more likely to survive the disease in the same way, you know, healthy bodies are or healthy people are.
So it has a lot to do with, for example, the democratic consensuses that are used or set to face these kind of situations. Now, one would think that, for example, when something like COVID-19 happens, Michael, you know, you need the figure, some like, for example, an epidemiologist, somebody who everybody believes in to actually lead the way and pave kind of the strategy to face a conflict like this. So I feel like societies are very polarized. And there's no trust in or believe in the institutions and the common consensuses built in democracies who face these kind of situations. COVID-19 must be a much worse problem than those where, you know, the institutions are strong and provide like a clear leadership. Would you agree?
Generally, yes, I would agree, but I would also say that it's not limited to that, Andy. You know, I mean, I think a strong leader is in many ways very important, certainly as sort of a uniting force and a voice for the country. But once again, it is these underlying, this broad array of attitudes, institutions, and structures. And those can be formal or informal as well. And of course, they can be national and they can be very local. It can be purely about how your neighbors are responding to the crisis, or how much you're able to help your neighbors in doing so. Let me give you a very, very quick example. The other day I was walking with my daughter, and in New Jersey, very recently where I am, there has been essentially a lockdown, and there's been a lot of complaints about people from New York essentially coming down to their second homes as the crisis was spreading, right? And there was a big hoo-ha about, oh, you know, everybody's coming down and they're going to make the situation worse here. And I was out walking with my daughter, and I walked by somebody's house that was close by. I'd never met them before. So I said, oh, hi, how are you doing? This, that, and the other. And I'm new to the area, and I've generally tried to learn more about my neighbors. And we start chatting, and he says, oh, yes, you know, I'm in this house, ruddy-rah. And I say, oh, are you here all the time? Are you here year-round? And he, for some reason, immediately disconnected from me and said, oh, I've got to go and do something inside, and went back inside. Now, in my case, I was just trying to sort of get to know my neighbor. But what I think would happen was that this was somebody who had come down from New York and thought that maybe I would kick up a stink. He was on the defensive, right? Now, think of the knock-on effects of this, Andy, right? Because that not only kind of sort of stalled that conversation in which I'd been able to sort of create a bond with my neighbor, if you will, but it also made me think, oh God, maybe I'm asking inappropriate questions here, right? And this is essentially now affected the way that I'm going to speak with other neighbors that I don't know, right? And it may actually limit the amount of times that I sort of speak with my neighbors and what I ask questions about.
I was going to say that it really kind of erodes the trust building activity between neighbors or, you know, between a society, right? Like if you can't actually develop a conversation without actually not feeling attacked or feeling like somebody's pointing the finger at you, it's really going to have an effect on being able to have these conversations that might lead or pave the way for a group society, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the U.S. has relatively high levels of positive peace, although that has been dropping for the last decade. But you can kind of sort of see how a crisis like this can have a different effect on different societies based on the levels of positive peace. And in countries with high levels of positive peace, we see the opposite. We see neighbors coming together. We see these kind of sort of support networks that are created. And there is a lot of this in the U.S. as well. Don't get me wrong. But I just wanted to kind of sort of show the example of how the same crisis can be resolved differently in different places based according to the levels of positive peace.
It's good that you mentioned the U.S. because one of the things that strikes out when one looks at the positive peace index is that the only region in the world to deteriorate in 10 years leading to 2018 is North America. And it's actually mainly because of the U.S., not so much because of Canada. How has this come to be? What has happened in the United States over the last 10, 12 years?
Yes, you're right. But I'd also like to clarify that there are a sort of within the other regions, if you will, there are a number of other countries where positive peace has decreased, right? It's just when making the regional sum, if you will, that it's a net positive for that region. So I just want to make it clear that the US is not the only country dropped in levels of positive peace. But you're right, you know, with regards to North America, Canada has fared a lot better and it has been dragged down mainly by the US. So, you know, the free flow of information pillar, which I was essentially talking about before in that example, that's deteriorated nearly 30%. And most of this is related to the quality of information pillar. Either contributing to it or because of this, there's been a radicalization of views, or parallel to this, there's been a radicalization of views related to how the economy should be managed, immigration, personal freedoms, and equality in the US. But this is also something that we're seeing in many countries around the world right now. And, you know, the 2020 Positive Peace Index, I think, is going to show much wider regional deteriorations, especially due to COVID-19.
Could you summarize some of the costs that violence and fear of violence create?
Sure. So the cost of violence on the economy last year was $14.5 trillion. That's 10% of the world's GDP, nearly $2,000 per person. That's, you know, amounted to about 40% of GDP for the 25 least peaceful nations and nearly 4% for the most peaceful nations. So that kind of sort of really highlights how you know, the impact that this has on on more fragile countries. A very large percentage of that, 80% essentially, is military expenditure and the security forces that are necessary to prevent and respond to violence. The actual percentage of things like armed conflict, for example, is relatively low. It's less than 5%. Homicide, suicide, violent crime account for the rest of those.
But when one looks in the indicators that help you measure, for example, the cost on the GDP, like, could you give some specific examples? Like, for example, do you measure the impact that violence has on hospitals or on levels of hospitalization? Or
that number is staggering, but we're actually very conservative. We measure the cost of violence over 16 dimensions, and we classify them, you know, pretty much as everything in sort of three domains, right? The first is the cost of security services, the military expenditure, the police force, the prison system, for example. The second is costs related to conflict. So this is the direct and indirect cost of lives lost and the impact on the economy broadly, which you're talking about here, but more in terms of productivity, so GDP. And three is related to interpersonal and self-inflicted violence as well. You know, this includes the direct and indirect cost of homicide, violent assault, suicide, and the fear of crime as well.
What is exactly the multiplier effect? I mean, because I've read on the report and I think it's a pretty interesting measure or kind of indicator.
Yeah, so the multiplier effect refers to essentially how much money is saved from a reduction in violence. You know, how money saved from a reduction in violence can be redirected to the economy and generate growth, right? Growth can be invested in business development or education. You know, the ability to take $1 from conflict, invest it, and make two.
It's almost like a domino effect. Well, we see a lot of unrest going on right now in the United States with the whole situation with COVID-19, but also with all the protests about George Floyd's death and systemic racism. And I was wondering, because I've heard a lot of talk about defunding police departments as a measure to try to maybe help solve the divide that is happening in the United States. Would you, you know, agree that maybe that would account for an example of the multiplier effect? Since we're talking about levels of police, you know, levels of deployment of police tactics, et cetera.
So you could make the case for defunding police as an example of that, I suppose, providing that you show that the investment does lead to growth, and critically that it leads to less police being needed, right? I mean, our work in this particular area is more about finding ways of minimizing the need for police rather than just not investing in it, right? I mean, despite all of our desires for the world to be completely peaceful, that's unlikely anytime soon. So it's likely the police force still needs to be maintained. But yes, I think that there is definitely a very justified question as to how that investment should be made, but it should be done also in parallel with drops in crime as well, right? So focusing on how do we drop crime and violence holistically rather than focusing singly on that particular element.
Now, another big topic is, of course, global warming. The report this year actually took that into account and its effects on peacefulness. But what is and will be the impact of global warming on global peace?
In a nutshell, tremendous. You know, especially when we take into account the growing population, for example. Global warming is going to increase food and water insecurity significantly. You know, the way things are looking right now, we expect essentially one quarter of all countries to suffer, you know, catastrophic food and water stress, essentially. You know, these stresses are likely going to sort of act as a catalyzer for conflict. So, you know, one example, in 2007, over 70% of the sort of the 500 water-related disputes in the world at the time were addressed positively and cooperatively, right? 2 years later, that dropped to 58%. Now, I don't have the latest data, but I'm pretty sure that has dropped significantly more. And overall, over 2.5 billion people right now live in areas with high exposure to climate hazards, and half of those already live in countries with low levels of positive peace, right? Or low levels of peace. And essentially, you know, weak institutions that are likely incapable of being able to deal with sort of the stress at that particular scale.
On the flip side of that, though, how are the countries with a higher level of positive peace better equipped to deal with the climate change?
Yeah. Well, they've got more measures at their disposal. Countries with high levels of positive peace, they can rely on the private sector to help innovate in areas of energy and crops and water desalinization, for example. The government is better placed to respond to humanitarian needs and to provide you know, the necessary information. They're more likely to reach new agreements with other countries related to trade or prime materials. The economy essentially is less reliant on a single stream of activities, right? So employment is more diversified. So it's less likely to take a hit all at once, for example. And you know, actually all of that essentially also gives it the ability to be able to dedicate more resources to proactively tackling climate change as well.
Definitely related to this issue, because we're starting to see a lot of refugees and internally displaced people due to climate change. What is the trend that one can observe with regards to refugees and internally displaced people overall?
So 70 million people currently displaced because of conflict. But, you know, that in itself only accounts for about 40% of the total amount. The other 60% stems from the increasing number of natural disasters, many of which are results of climate change. So natural disasters have tripled in number over the last 40 years. And by 2050, we estimate that climate change is going to create, you know, an additional 86 million refugees in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, 40 million in South Asia, and 17 million in Latin America. So that's nearly 150, if you will, additional people without a home that are going to need support. I think much needs to be done for that not to affect other countries as well.
One can see that maybe the rise in certain populist and nationalistic attitudes in, for example, the European continent or in the United States or some other countries has to do with the levels of migration and refugees that are trying to enter their countries. Would you say that this is a factor to take into consideration when one looks at or how it might affect a country's peacefulness in the future?
Yes, definitely. You know, we definitely do see correlation in Europe, for example, as to the rise of tensions and the Syrian refugee crisis there. I mean, it has to be, or it is very difficult to prepare socially and economically for that kind of influx, right? Especially if your own country is suffering from increased pressure as well. So, you know, it's just kind of sort of one more hit, if you will, that makes it more difficult to take. And yes, I do think that there is a significant likelihood of increased conflict. So one of the things that IEP is working on right now is what we call an ecological threat register. And what that does is essentially is it takes all of the different sort of forms of ecological threat that are projected for the next 35, 40 years until 2050, essentially, and then cross-references that, if you will, with a country's level of positive peace to be able to better identify what are the countries that are going to be most vulnerable to this. And then subsequently through that, be able to kind of sort of assess what the patterns of human migration will be, which is essentially an exercise that we've already done. But then importantly, also highlight the impact that will likely have on neighboring countries as well. And in summary, Andy, I think that yes, there is high potential for conflict. But the good news is that we still have time to work on that, right? The important thing is to have the data to be able to support it and then to be able to conduct the advocacy and develop the policy and programming at that level to be able to make sure that either that migration isn't necessary or that there can be better methods of support for the people who will be displaced. I also think that there's still, you know, a very small window to be able to tackle climate change directly as well. So of course, all of these should be a priority.
Hopefully we can all find mechanisms in which we can have joint conversations and multilateral kind of approaches to these global problems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that kind of sort of gives me so much hope is the engagement of young people and their level of leadership. A lot of the multilateral institutions have kind of sort of been blindsided in many ways by issues that have been a long time coming, that have been evident, but these large institutions have been unable to adapt to, right? It's a bit kind of sort of like, you know, like the Titanic or sort of a large boat that takes a long time to turn around. But the level of mobilization and engagement from young leaders around the world has been fantastic to see. And I think that a large amount of change in society is going to be coming from that particular group.
I definitely agree. I see all my peers working on different issues and everything like that. And I think it's really great. But I would really like to thank you, Michael, and all of IEP for joining us today. I know Andy and I greatly enjoyed this conversation and really learned a lot. It definitely was interesting to see all these trends and to continue to look at what it will be like for 2020 and beyond. Again, this is the Peace Production, the Organization for World Peace's podcast. I am Monica Sager, and I hope you tune in with us next time for our next episode.